Older people often suffer with undiagnosed and untreated depression. My guest, Dr. Charles Reynolds, says depression should not be regarded as a normal part of aging. Reynolds directs a research center for late-life mood disorders that is funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It's based at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, where he's a professor of psychiatry, neurology, and neuroscience. Among the things he studied is the use of antidepressants in people over 70. Dr. Reynolds, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, there are so many reasons to be depressed if you're very old. There's declining health that's probably not going to improve. Maybe you've lost a spouse. You've probably lost friends. You're facing more decline as you get older, and you know that that's just going to be followed by death. So you'd maybe say that depression is a natural and even almost sensible state to be in, given what you're facing. What would you say to that?
What's really, I think, surprising, Terry, is how many older people are resilient to clinical depression, despite the losses that accompany old age, perhaps bereavement or changes in health status that make one more dependent or frail. Most people don't, in fact, develop the symptoms and signs of clinical depression. Rather, they're able to cope actively with the challenges of old age. Perhaps 2 in 10 people do, however, become clinically depressed, and it's important that they be identified and offered appropriate treatment.
Now, I was once told by a doctor, by an internist, that antidepressants aren't as effective in the elderly as they are with other people, and that also antidepressants won't be effective if an older person's depression seems to be situational, like the loss of a spouse or like facing, you know, chronic health problems. Do you think that doctor was correct?
The data really do suggest otherwise, and let me tell you what I mean. Clinical trials involving the use of antidepressant medications have matured in the last 10 to 20 years, and what we've shown, in essence, is that situational depression, such as depression following bereavement, in fact, is quite responsive to antidepressant medication and allows the person who is bereaved to be in a better position for doing the work of grief. It removes one of the barriers to doing appropriate grief work and to adjusting to life, say, without the spouse.
Do you find that a lot of elderly people are resistant to even talking to a psychiatrist because they grew up in a time when psychiatry was considered, you know, for the mentally ill, and the word mentally ill was such a stigmatized word. You know, I've known older people who will look at you and say, I'm not crazy, therefore I don't need to see a psychiatrist and I certainly don't need any medication.
I do think that is the case. The older generation of Americans, I think, have a very different personal model of what depression is. And we should say that depression doesn't mean that you're crazy. It's a treatable medical illness. At the same time, I think many older Americans may take the view that depression may somehow represent a moral failing or a characterologic flaw, rather than an illness like diabetes or hypertension, which can be diagnosed and treated. You see that attitude expressed as well in preferences, if one is to have treatment at all, to be treated in the primary care setting, rather than being referred out to a mental health specialist. My own view happens to be that it's very appropriate for most older Americans living with depression to be treated in the primary care setting. Depression treatment is often a very straightforward medical undertaking. Geriatric mental health specialists like myself can be called in as consultants, or we can offer an opinion on a particularly difficult to manage situation.
When you do talk therapy, as I assume you do with some older patients who you see?
Correct, yes.
Can you give us a sense of what therapy is like what topics you'd bring up, and especially if somebody's older and maybe like their memory isn't as good as it used to be, maybe they even have a little bit of dementia? I mean, how does talk therapy work when your mind isn't what it used to be?
Talk therapy is actually very helpful for older people with depression. think it's important to emphasize that all of these therapies are relatively brief. They're very active. The patient is not lying on a couch, as you might think of in terms of traditional psychoanalysis. Rather, the patient and the therapist are actively engaged in one form of problem solving or another. Take interpersonal psychotherapy as an example. Here, we're very often dealing with issues related to bereavement, such as the loss of a spouse, or transitions in major social roles, such as can be seen in the wake of retirement. We might also be dealing with interpersonal conflicts. Let's suppose an older person with depression is becoming increasingly frail or dependent upon a caregiver, and that relationship is becoming somewhat conflictual. One of the important focuses of IPT, interpersonal therapy, in a situation like that, is to help improve communication with the caregiver in order to lower the amount of tension or stress that's in that relationship. Not infrequently, we'll also invite the caregiver or significant other in the patient's family to join briefly in the therapy in order to help clarify the situation or to improve communication.
Now, I know while you were doing your residency at the University of Pittsburgh, one of your grandparents committed suicide at the age of 89. And I understand that that helped lead you to study geriatric psychiatry. What happened? What do you know about why your grandparent committed suicide?
Yeah, this was my grandfather, Mr. Charlie, as he was called. I'm actually named for him. He was a very successful Mississippi farmer. He raised cotton. He was a really great guy, very vital, and as far as I know, had never experienced any depression in his life until he reached very old age. And in his mid to late 80s, Mr. Charlie, as he was called, suffered a stroke. He also developed a very painful case of herpes, which is common in older people who are frail or whose immune systems are compromised. And my speculation, Terry, is that in the wake of these medical insults, which were very disabling for him, so that he couldn't really practice farming anymore, I think he came to feel that his life was pointless. He became pessimistic and hopeless. And as is the case with many older Americans living in the rural parts of our country, he had relatively limited access to medical care. Certainly he had virtually no access to mental health specialty care. So I think he made the decision that he had no more, in a sense, windmills to tilt at. And he had a gun in his house, and as the case with many older men who die by suicide, he shot himself in the head. I found out about that after the fact, and as your question suggested, it had a profound impact on me, both as his grandson, but also as a budding young psychiatrist at that point. And so for the last 25 years, this has been the focus of a lot of the scientific and clinical work that I've done. And I think we've made a lot of progress to trying to prevent the sort of thing that happened to my grandfather.
Did people in your family feel that if they had intervened in some way that they might have prevented him from killing himself?
Oh, yes. I think this is always, Terry, the emotional legacy of suicide within a family. You always have to ask yourself if it was preventable. And yet, the science, I think, tells us two things here that are very important to take note of. A lot of suicide in old age is preventable because it's the product of depression, which is a treatable illness. My colleagues and I have shown that if you appropriately treat depression in old age, you greatly lower or reduce the amount of suicidal ideation. At the same time, it's important to remember that mental illnesses, like other illnesses, are sometimes fatal. They can be terminal. And it's not possible, in fact, to prevent all cases of suicide, even under the best of circumstances.
Let me raise a question, and this gets to an issue that I think a lot of people talk about with people that they're comfortable with. You know, there is a lot of people feel now that we are able to be kept alive medically past the point where anybody would really want to be alive. In other words, that through surgeries and drugs and other therapies, you could be incredibly frail, in a lot of pain, you know, with no hope of any real improvement. And that, like, earlier people would die of, like, heart attacks and strokes and stuff. And now, you know, thank goodness there's medicine that can get you, that can enable you to survive things that would have killed you. But you're surviving at a very old age in a very frail, compromised state and in a very unhappy state. And, I mean, people are living in ways that they just never did before. I'm sorry for stammering here, but it's a very uncomfortable subject to discuss. But there's just a lot of people who say, if I get to that point, I don't want to live that way.
I'm glad that you asked the question, because it's a conversation that we need to have as a nation, isn't it? As well as within our own families and with our primary care physicians. The fastest growing segment of the population in the U.S. is actually people above the age of 85, that is to say, the frail elderly. We're now learning a good deal more about how to help the elderly age successfully so that the period of functional morbidity that you described so well in your question.
What does functional morbidity mean?
Prolonged inability to engage in the activities of daily living that give one meaning and a sense of pleasure in life, so that that period of dependency on others increasingly, we think, will be decreased. And I think that's important to keep that perspective in mind as we go forward together as a nation, as a developed economy, with an increasing number of elderly people. That said, it's very important for all of us to have discussions with family members, caregivers, ministers, physicians, about what our core values and preferences are, about the extent of treatment and support that we want at the end of life. So often we don't have those conversations. They aren't reflected in living wills, for example. And yet, if we do have those conversations with significant others and with our physicians, I think the chances are that we'll have a greater sense of control at the end of life and prevent the kind of scenario that you described.
Of course, you know, living wills never say, I have a gun and at a certain point, let me use it. Do you know what I mean? And without sounding cold, I'm wondering if there was anybody in your family who said about your grandfather after he killed himself, God bless him, he knew what he wanted. He got to a point where he no longer wanted to live. He had a gun. He made a rational choice. And, you know, who can argue with it? Maybe he knew what his limits were, and by his standards, he did the right thing.
You know, I think that's a very understandable point of view, and I've struggled with that myself. And at times, I think, Terry, I've comforted myself as a grandson with that point of view. You know, at the same time, though, the science tells us something that may be slightly different from that interpretation, and that is that if you provide appropriate clinical management or treatment to an elder living with depression or with emotional or spiritual or psychological pain, very often their desire to end their lives may actually go away, and they may decide that it's worth sticking around for a little bit longer.
What advice would you have for people who have an elderly parent or grandparent or spouse who they really feel is depressed and could benefit by some kind of psychiatric help, but the person who is depressed doesn't comprehend that they're depressed, and they refuse to do anything about it, to see anybody about it, and in fact even accept it as an insult that somebody would think that they are depressed and that they need help?
Your question is so very important because, as you've just said, many older people simply don't or won't recognize clinical depression in themselves. Also, it's very difficult to be the family member or caregiver of an older person with depression. Depression is almost like a contagious illness, and many of the caregivers of our depressed patients are themselves suffering from mild forms of depression. There's some practical things that a family member or a caregiver can do. First of all, it may be better not to use the D word, the depression word, which may be so stigmatized for older Americans that it represents an absolute barrier to help seeking. Instead of depression, they hear crazy. So it may actually be better to use terms that are out of the everyday vocabulary or experience of an older depressed person. Perhaps they're tired day in and day out or not enjoying most of their usual activities. Maybe they're worried. Maybe they're not sleeping well. So a family member can talk to the older person in terms of their actual lived experience of depression. Under those circumstances, it's often possible to persuade an older family member to get help. Now, the help may be from a trusted professional. Perhaps that is going to be a minister or a priest or a rabbi. Maybe it's going to be a primary care doc with whom they've worked for many years. The important point is that they're beginning to get help from some appropriate source. And then if the primary care doc, for example, feels that he or she needs a second opinion, they can call in a mental health specialist to give that opinion about managing a tricky situation, for example.
Dr. Reynolds, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Great interview, Terry. Thank you.
Dr. Charles Reynolds is a professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, where he directs the Intervention Research Center for Late Life Mood Disorders. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with a track featuring keyboard player Joe Zawinul. He died of cancer today at the age of 75. Through his work playing electric piano on the Miles Davis albums In a Silent Way and Bitches Brew, and by founding the band Weather Report, he became a leading figure in jazz fusion. Before playing with Miles, he spent 9 years with Cannonball Adderley. This is Adderley and Zawinul's 1966 hit, Mercy, 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 which was composed by Zawinul.